This podcast may contain disturbing content for some listeners. It's intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised. This is True Crime XS.
Got some new body camera footage and 911 calls released by the Phoenix police involving a very tense and deadly domestic violence incident.
It was a tragedy in North Phoenix nearly 2 weeks ago, ending with police shooting and killing the suspect. And we need to warn you, some of the footage you're about to see is graphic. Justin Lum joins us live at police headquarters with more tonight.
John Kerry, we're learning more about what transpired after a mother and her son were found critically injured inside their home. A family of four destroyed by domestic violence, and police say the suspect, the father, also wanted to take his own life. Now his young daughter is the only one alive.
On the night of October 25th, a resident living near I-17 and Jomax Road called 911, saying his neighbor, 53-year-old Paul Sarver, wanted to borrow his gun.
But I think he's gonna hurt himself. I don't know about the other two in the house.
Sarver had brought his 11-year-old daughter, Audrey, to their neighbor's home.
She's confused and scared and freaking out in my house. She thinks that he killed somebody.
Then Sarver calls 911, telling the dispatcher that police needed to come to his house, saying what's going on is really bad.
Is anything physical or just a verbal argument? Who is that?
It's physical.
Sarver did not provide much more information.
Who needs medical attention?
Better hit.
Two officers arrived at the home. Body cam video shows a man later identified as Sarver walk towards them in the street, claiming he has a gun, pointing at the officers. Both officers fire several shots.
Stay out!
Ultimately, Sarver didn't have a gun. Police found a black eyeglass case next to him as he died at the scene. Inside the home, investigators found Sarver's wife, 46-year-old Shannon Hirsch, and their son, 13-year-old Caden, in extremely critical condition. Hirsch died at the hospital. Caden passed away just days later from his injuries.
Now, loved ones of Shannon Hirsch continue to raise money for her family, specifically her daughter, who's now without both parents, and her brother. We've shared the GoFundMe account on Fox10Phoenix.com. Live at Phoenix Police Headquarters, Justin Lum, Fox 10 News.
One of the things that's very interesting to me about homicides is we don't really solve homicides in the U.S. We had this period of time, like pre-Miranda and pre-modern legal mechanisms for searches and for interrogations, where homicide rates were very high. In some areas, the average was, you know, over 90% for homicide solve rates. And there were different ways of dealing with murders, as far as reporting goes, if you look at the early history of American criminal justice system. But the truth is, we don't solve murders, not well. And the way to look at that is, as we get more things on the books and more things on paper, and we can look at it now with algorithms, we can see that like the murder rate in this country is very high and the clearance rate is very low. The clearance rate is, you know, on average between 50 and 60%, depending on the region and jurisdiction that you're in. And then, you know, there are multiple factors that raise the murder rate, including like missing persons cases that are not considered murders, but actually are. And, you know, just people not being reported missing and not being reported murdered by consequence. But the truth is, we don't solve murders, not the FBI, not the local police, not state police, not sheriffs. We don't solve murders. And people will argue and say that that's not true, but it is true. One of the most common things that can happen, however, is a lot of the murders that are cleared, those homicides are cleared because it's pretty obvious. You've got a confession, you've got a suspect, you've got a video. And even now we're finding out that like 3 to 4% of those we're wrong on. That we, you know, they get adjudicated, they get a conviction, they have a sentence, they appear to have justice, but we're wrong. And it could be as high as 10% in, you know, various jurisdictions that for whatever reason, they don't do as well with homicides. But the truth is, overall, the criminal justice system doesn't deal with homicides, which is it's the worst crime. There are other crimes that are, you know, subjectively considered to be worse when it comes to children and when it comes to certain types of assaults where, you know, the victim is alive and dealing with the trauma after the fact. But the truth is, we don't solve murders. So if you look at a handful of like domestic violence murders where it was the husband did it or the spouse did it or whatever, some of those cases can't be right. I feel awful when victims' families don't get justice, whether it's, you know, a Ted Bundy type case or like a much simpler case. But what's worse is when defendants become the convicted and they didn't do it. I'm not saying that any of these cases could potentially be like that, but I have seen, I picked this area that we're looking at because I have seen in that area police and police technicians who lie to solve cases. One of the biggest things that happens in the middle of all of these cases we're covering right now is that Michael Peterson is once again up for, like, his case is up for all of the appellate processes to come to the result that it came to. And the thing about Michael Peterson's case is it is a great example of how we don't solve murders in this country. Because Michael Peterson's case, it's not even that they didn't solve the murder, it's that they made a murder out of nothing. If you look at Michael Peterson's case and consider that to be a homicide, you really shouldn't be a prosecutor. You really should not be any type of law enforcement if that is your version of a homicide. Because Michael Peterson's case was very simple. It was an accidental death that probably involved an owl. And no matter, like, I've been to that area. I've seen the other reports of what happened there. And I know that's like a novel thing to look at, but it is an accidental death. And it, like I said, it probably involved an owl. How else do you explain the evidence on the fringes of it? But once again, not only do we not solve murders, we make murders needlessly out of situations that were not murders to begin with. But if you take a series of murders that have like domestic violence connections and you look at 10 or 12 or 15 of them, chances are one or two of those, they were not the outcome that they got in court. We are very, very much biased against people close to the victims. And that's not to say that like people close to victims of homicides don't kill them. That's not to say that like they're all innocent either, because that's another extreme that's a problem. In these cases where you see what is considered to be like very passionate killings, whatever, and they throw in a little premeditation and suddenly he's got a first degree homicide between two spouses, it's not always the case. And we don't know the difference, not psychologically, not criminology wise. The justice system, it is blind, and that's a problem because it doesn't know what the hell is going on.
The state has to prove the husband killed the wife. Okay. And it can't just be like, oh, well, obviously he killed her. Who else did it? Like, that's not how that works. And it could be pretty generally assumed and assumed correctly. A lot of times it is a spouse. I said husband and wife just because that's what we're talking about. But the spouse would be responsible because you don't come across a whole lot of situations where there is somebody with motive and opportunity to kill somebody because of the way like our domestic type lifestyles are. Now, there's always the chance that it could be a serial killer, right? I mean, always. There's always
but it's
that
so narrow that, and I learned this from you, like it's right. So unlikely that it's going to happen that way.
Right. Okay. And so in this case, I have no idea if he killed his wife. I do know that if he didn't do it, then I would assume it's somebody that it was random and it was a serial killer. But I don't think that's what happened.
I do have like one specific question about this. Have you heard the 911 call?
I think I just
So he says in the 911 call
that she was shot.
Is that bullshit?
Yeah, but is he smart enough to do that?
He is not the smartest guy from what I can tell. But he was smart enough to take
I have no idea, but right. Okay. And so that's another thing that there is something to be said for the holdouts, but there's also something to be said for those who don't hold out.
Well, and I can speak from personal experience that it's incredibly hard to hold out.
Yeah. Right. Because you are just pounded. I mean, and I found that a lot of times it doesn't work, even in a sense, like you don't end up in a bargaining position, because it is a personal thing for these prosecutors who have to get these convictions, and they're not actually, it's a natural human thing to want to succeed in your career. Well, seeking justice to unsolved cases that you can't solve does not promote your career as a prosecutor. Getting convictions, whether people are guilty or not, is what would promote a career. Now, I'm not saying that that's what's happening. I'm just saying you can sort of follow the yellow brick road the way that goes. Having a spouse convicted is better than having an unsolved case in the eyes of somebody who advances their career by getting convictions.
A large percentage of cases that either plea out or go to trial, guilty circumstances for, you know, whatever, it doesn't really matter. Like, and I'm not talking about in just murder cases. Murder cases, it's more interesting to see, because I do think a higher percentage of those go to trial no matter what. I don't even think that's necessarily a matter of innocence or guilt. It's sometimes just a matter of we can't reach an agreement. And that's one of the other things is Raven Abaroa, not one trial. It's going to be a second trial. Doesn't come to the second trial on the eve of the second trial because they reach an agreement. And
at that point, he had been in jail.
So this is what I
want
to say about this case, and then I'm going to move on to the other one because it's so weird. First of all, yes, he had been in jail for 4 years. But I want you to think about this. If he didn't kill his wife, he sat there for 4 years in jail.
I am with you.
That is horrible.
Well, he didn't just get out then. He still had time to serve. He didn't get out until 17.
Right.
So he had
but I'm saying if he didn't kill his wife, then this guy just sat in jail for 7 years. And like, even now there are still articles that pop up in People about that case. There'll be little blurbs just saying like her sister said this or her brother said that. And I'm like, that guy's never going to get away from that. So if he didn't kill his wife, his life is ruined anyway.
Right. Okay. So yes, you're correct in that statement, but why is that assumption? The reason that accepted as the fact that like, okay, he sat in jail for 7 years and may or may not have killed his wife is because he is assumed to have killed her.
Right, there's no good answer here, by the way. This is not a thing where I can back it up. I'm just saying if he didn't,
it's
the worst thing that could ever happen to a person.
Well, and you know what? It's interesting that you say that because I saw a case recently, and this is not one we're covering, but just really quick, what I saw was that it was a husband whose wife disappeared. She ultimately was found killed. And the husband was really surprised that he was suspect. It was very brief, though. And it ended up being somebody else that had killed her. And it was one of those rare situations where I don't feel like watching the husband talk that he realized how close he was to spending the rest of his life in jail without additional information that the cops bothered to go and get. And so what I thought about that case was what made them entertain the information that they received.
It's called doing their job.
And they didn't. Well, I understand that, but it was still amazing that they didn't just hone in on him and convict him. That's so many times.
And sometimes
that's
what it's laziness.
The reason, though, honestly, and you know, we don't know for sure, but just sort of a general observation, the reason that it happens and it's sort of accepted is because it most of the time is. They most of the time did it. Who else knows somebody well enough?
Yeah, but there comes
them?
A point in there where the statistics start to get skewed. If enough husbands just plead out and cops just keep going, oh, well, they did it to him.
Okay, yeah, but take out the, like, let's not look at the adjudicated portion of this. Let's just look at events and think about it just, you know, briefly. And it could be male or female. When a spouse dies, fortunately, we still live in a society where most people don't go around murdering other people for no reason. When you are married, with or without children, working or staying at home with your children, how much, especially right now during the pandemic, I mean, this is a different world, but how much interaction do you have the opportunity to have with people that could get close enough to stab you to death in your bed?
Right.
Okay. And that's where I kind of say, well, even if somebody was going to kill me, they wouldn't come into my house and stab me to death in my bed. Somebody that was going to kill me, that wasn't my husband. Okay. But what I'm saying is, like, when you think about it that way, I mean, yes, there are a few serial killers out there, and there are a few random acts of violence that they result in someone being murdered. For the most part, whether they are convicted or not, whether they are, you know, we ever know or not, there's a reason that someone has to have opportunity in proving a murder case as far as the legal system goes, because it's a special set of circumstances that allows for you to end up stabbed to death in your bed. And only so many people would have that.
I totally agree with you. And that, I just want to, okay, so first up, we had, you know, Janet Christensen, and they've gone back to using the name Christensen with her. She was killed.
Yeah.
And then that's 2005. 2006, Michelle Young is murdered in the same area. This is Wake County, North Carolina. Now, the Abaroa case takes place in Durham County, which is next to Wake County.
She was always, you know, peppy and alive and smiling, and we would always have a lot of fun together.
Linda Fisher took the witness stand heartbroken, sharing memories of her daughter, Michelle Young.
She was involved in a language club. She wanted a large school. She would have loved to cheer. We did the road trip, came to NC State, and loved it.
Michelle graduated from North Carolina State, went on to get a master's degree, and started a career in accounting. On October 10th, 2003, Michelle married Jason Young. A few months later, they had their first child, a beautiful little girl they named Cassidy.
She was a great mother.
I love you, Mommy.
I love you, too.
With a baby girl and a husband, Michelle was living her dream.
Michelle always wanted to be married, have a family.
And that family was growing. In November 2006, Michelle and Jason were preparing for their second child, a boy they planned to name Rylan. Then, tragedy struck.
I think my sister's dead. Oh my God.
On November 3rd, 2006, Michelle's sister Meredith found Michelle face down in a pool of blood. 2-year-old Cassidy had placed a baby doll next to her mother's body. Police found the toddler's bloody footprints all over the scene.
Sweetie, did you know what happened to Mama? Did she fall?
Emergency officials rushed to Michelle's house, but it was too late. The killer had beaten her so badly, her jaw was broken, her skull was fractured, and several of her teeth were knocked out. Days passed without an arrest. Then months. Finally, 3 years later, prosecutors charged Michelle's husband, Jason, with murder. He admits their relationship was rocky and that he cheated on Michelle, but he says that's the only thing he's guilty of.
Were you there when it happened?
No, sir.
Do you know who did it?
No, sir.
Did you have anything to do with killing her?
No, sir.
Let's bring in criminal defense attorney Anna Smith. She's in Raleigh. She's followed both of these cases. Ms. Smith, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Sure. So, general, I just want to ask you generally, since you followed both of these cases, how do you think it's going for the defense up to this point?
Well, I think it's very important to remember that there is no direct evidence leading this defendant to this murder. And that's just very hard for any prosecution to overcome. It's also hard to overcome that there's 6 unidentified prints that are within that home. that are not related to the defendant. And so that's hard for any prosecution to overcome.
Well, if you were defending him, would you put him back on the stand as he was put on the stand in the first trial?
I probably would. As the old saying says, don't fix something that's not broken. And they did it right the first time. And, you know, they got eight jurors to believe that he was not guilty, and he did testify. So I assume that they're probably going to do that same strategy.
There are so many things, though, that just don't add up about Jason Young, I think, to a lot of people. And one of the biggest is the fact that 2-year-old Cassidy was in that home, most likely saw something, and was not injured at all. Nor was the dog who was barking. How, and the fact that he never spoke to attorneys, he never inquired about the investigation. He never asked whether they were close to finding out who did this to his wife. He never even asked them when they talked to him initially and told them that his wife was dead. He never asked how his 2-year-old daughter was. How, from a defense standpoint, do you overcome some of that, which, you know, when I listen to people on Facebook and Twitter, those are some of the things they have the hardest time reconciling.
Well, and I certainly understand those concerns. However, of course, I am a defense attorney, but it's my understanding through listening to some of the testimony that he was instructed by his attorneys immediately not to speak to anyone, including that of his family, and that he was certainly just simply complying with their request. So with that being said, it's not that unusual, although to, you know, someone outside of the legal field, it may seem so.
Well, as I understand it, he actually had not hired an attorney yet when he refused to speak to investigators, and he actually hung up on them. How do you explain that away? Because some people may interpret that as guilty.
And you're exactly right. Some may do that. My understanding and the testimony that I've heard actually in the courtroom is that when he returned from Virginia immediately to the sister-in-law's house, that while he was there, investigators came to speak to him there, and he simply denied, you know, any right or conversations with them, that he had already contacted an attorney. So that was my first inkling that he had already spoken with an attorney just upon his arrival back from Virginia.
Mm-hmm. And I know you watched the first trial. One of the new elements of this case was the testimony we've been talking about this morning from the daycare workers and what they observed about 2-year-old Cassidy just days after her mother had been murdered. How do you counter some of what they're saying came out of a 2.5-year-old's mouth?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that one more time, please?
No problem. How do you counter, from a defense standpoint, what the daycare workers said about 2-year-old Cassidy role-playing about somebody beating up her mommy?
Well, it certainly was an emotional card for the jury. I mean, to hear that a child, you know, 2 years old may have seen her mother being murdered. I do think it was important that the judge limited that instruction to say, this is not for identification purposes. She never indicated it was her father, which she could have. She never used the male doll that was there as an option while she illustrated. And so it's simply that she may have witnessed it, and that the assailant knew that she witnessed it and may have left her unharmed. I don't necessarily agree with that. I do believe that if someone's intent came into the home to murder the mother, there may be several people that would have left an innocent 2-year-old unscathed.
And that's funny, because a lot of investigators, or specifically Mike Brooks, who consults with us, he's an analyst and says he does not believe, based on his experience, yes, there are people who would not hurt a child, but to go in and hurt and murder so brutally somebody the way that she was murdered, you have to discount robbery as a motive here. And it only makes it more perplexing that they would not do something to the one and only witness. What do you say to that?
And I believe you said, I apologize, it's a little hard to hear, but that you said, did they discount a robbery? I think it was interesting yesterday that some of the testimony was that in the search warrants, when they were applying in the affidavits, that they were looking for certain pieces of jewelry that were located, should have been located in the home, such as a ring, I believe there was a white gold bracelet, and some other extensive items of jewelry that they expected to find in the marital home, and they never did. And they didn't find them through the search warrants of Jason Young's mother, his sister's house, or anywhere else. So I guess it's possible that those items were actually taken from the home at the time of the murder.
Okay, thank you so much. It was so good to have you with us, Anna. I appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
Holly man convicted of murdering his pregnant wife may soon be getting a new trial. In 2012, a jury found Jason Young guilty of murdering Michelle Young at their home 11 years ago.
CBS North Carolina's David Hurst joins us live from the Wake County Justice Center, where a judge is considering a new trial. David?
Yeah, Sean, Sharon, if a judge grants Young's request here, then it will be the third time this case will be tried. The first trial ended in a hung jury with the majority of jurors favoring an acquittal for Young. The second time, though, a few years later, a jury found Young guilty of first-degree murder. Young ended up appealing that conviction, though, and the Court of Appeals vacated the verdict. However, the state Supreme Court overruled that decision, and now both sides are back arguing over whether or not Young deserves a new trial. Young's attorneys claim his case should be heard again because his defense team was ineffective during the trial when he was convicted.
But their failure to do legal research, failure to file motions in limine, and failure to object properly both to the wrongful death and the Slayer declaration and the child custody complaint was below an objective standard of reasonable performance, and it was deficient.
The evidence showed a pattern of behavior on the part of the defendant. Couldn't be faithful to a relationship when they were just dating. He couldn't be faithful to his wife once they were married.
Now, the judge says he will take both arguments into consideration, review all the evidence, and make a decision sometime in the next few weeks. Reporting live in Wake County, I'm David Hurst, CBS.
Claims he couldn't have committed the murder because he was asleep in a hotel room in Hillsville, Virginia, 3 hours away. Prosecution trying to pick apart his alibi by presenting evidence that suggests Young left his hotel the night of the murder. Let me walk you through their timeline of what they believe happened here. This is a shot of Jason Young checking into the Hampton Inn around 10:50 p.m. on November 2nd. Young then takes the elevator up to room 421, where he swipes his room key card at 10:54 p.m. This next image is Young entering a door that leads into the lobby. Take a look at the time. It's now 11:58 p.m. Here's a shot of Young back at the front desk, also at 11:59 p.m. It appears that he picks up a newspaper. And then he's seen walking down a hallway at 11:59 p.m. Young claims he went outside to smoke a cigar and then went back to his room. But evidence shows Young's room key was only swiped once, just before 11 p.m. The state claims Young left the hotel right around midnight and drove the 3 hours back to Raleigh to kill his wife. That puts him back home around 3 a.m. A newspaper delivery woman says she passed the Youngs home between 3:30 and 4 a.m. and saw all the lights on and a light colored SUV near the driveway. Now, fast forward to sometime between 5 and 5:30 a.m. A convenience store clerk testifies she recalls Jason Young stopping in to get gas at a station located in King, North Carolina. That's about 45 minutes to an hour from the hotel in Hillsville, Virginia. At 5:50 a.m., a hotel employee says he found a side door dropped open with this lava rock and the security camera above that door unplugged. He says he kicked the rock out and plugged the camera back in. But then, less than an hour later, a maintenance worker finds that the same security camera is pointed up toward the ceiling. This is an image of a handprint on the water pipe above the camera. The wires on the middle left of your screen are from the camera. Now, it's interesting to note the camera was moved sometime around 6 a.m., but the door was no longer propped open. But take a look at this sign. that door actually unlocked at 6 a.m. Doesn't need to be propped open. So if you got back after 6, you could just walk in that door. Now, let me walk you through the path that Young took through the hotel based on witness testimony. He leaves room 421, passes two rooms, and walks through this door on the east end of the hotel. He takes the stairs down to the first floor and goes through the door on the right. That takes him into a hallway that leads to the lobby. He walks up to the reception desk where he's caught on camera at 11:59 p.m. He then turns left and walks down another hallway towards an exit door. Here he takes the door to the left, not the glass exit door at the end of the hallway. Young then goes outside via the emergency exit on the west side. It was this door that was found propped open with a security camera above it, first unplugged and then later pointed upwards. One last image I want you to take a look at. It's a side-by-side comparison. Young at the reception desk. One is at 10:50, one at 11:58 p.m. Look at the clothes, folks. Look at what he's wearing. Is he wearing the same thing? I see over here a little stripe or something going on here. I don't see that over here. Did he change his clothes? If so, why? Where was he going? You know? Why? And it looks like it's a different color, too. It looks a lot lighter over here than it does over here. What exactly is going on with his wardrobe selection? Jason Young, you know, had a business meeting in Clintwood, Virginia around 10 a.m. on November 3rd, but arrived about half an hour late, he claimed.
Did there come a time when you learned that she was pregnant?
Yes.
Tell us about that. How did you find that out? What was your reaction?
That was at the townhome at Arete Way that Ryan and I had purchased. And I remember I was upstairs in the bedroom, and Michelle went, we were in the master bedroom, and there's a bathroom attached to that. And I remember Michelle coming out and announcing that she was pregnant.
What was your reaction to that?
We were both very shocked. We were both eye-opening, like, whoa. It was, you know, it was a surprise. It wasn't planned, but it was a surprise, but it was a good surprise.
Do you remember telling your mom about that?
I do.
Describe that conversation. Was that the way it happened?
Yes, it was. I think Michelle was nervous about that, and she was like, "You really just want to tell your mom like that?" I'm like, "Yeah, I don't think Michelle knew at that point how close." Like, I was like, "Mom, well, this will be a good thing. Mom will be so excited to be a grandmom." I'm like, "This will be a really neat thing for her." So I actually was pretty excited to tell my mom.
She testified that she told you, if you love her, marry her.
Yes.
And did you?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, I did.
So, thinking about it in that respect, did her getting pregnant cause you to get married?
No, it didn't cause us to get married. It certainly expedited the marriage. It sped up.
It happened sooner.
Absolutely. It made it happen. It made it happen sooner. I think it was eventually going to happen on my schedule. It would have probably been stretched out a little more. On her schedule, it would have probably been a little sooner. So it expedited both of those schedules.
When she became pregnant again, how did you feel about that?
I was ecstatic.
Did it come a time when you learned that that child was going to be a boy?
Yes.
Tell us about that. How did you find that out, and what was your reaction?
Well, we went together. A lot of the appointments, as many of the appointments that I could go on with her, I would go on. And this was the big one, obviously, the one finding out the sex of the baby, if you can. It all depends on if the baby will cooperate. But I remember going on and them doing the procedure to show, and you're watching a screen, and I just remember, the baby's moving in there. It's very active, but I remember the the technician, the baby turned, and you could see kind of the legs, and you could kind of see a little.
Okay, and you realized it was a boy.
Male part, yes.
And how'd that make you think?
It was. I think both of us were thrilled. It couldn't be more perfect. And what I mean by that certainly is that we would have been disappointed if it was a girl, because Cassidy, there's nothing that's better than that. But I think we both wanted to experience having a girl and a boy, and it was, it couldn't have been more storybook, and that's right up Michelle's alley, what she would have wanted.
How did you find out that she was pregnant?
It was typical Michelle fashion. She planned it out, and I remember Cassidy, in the toddling stage, toddling into the den, and she had a shirt on that Michelle bought that said, "I'm going to be a big sister," and I don't even think, just being the non-pay attention person, I don't even think it hit me at first. I remember just seeing more Cassidy and kind of thinking, played with Cassidy, and Michelle was looking at me kind of like excited-wise, and I remember looking again, and I was thrilled.
Wake County, North Carolina. Jason Young. And this is another one that is live streamed and I participate in. But the outcome is completely different. So the gist of his case is Jason Young has one interesting thing going for him. And if he did this, I don't think he could have done it alone. The only interesting thing he has going for him is he has what appears to be a rock solid alibi that the prosecutors just chip away at and chip away at and chip away at. And that is, he is so far out of town that he could not have done the murder. He couldn't have gotten back to do the murder and then driven back, like, to the point that, like, the cops investigated had he rented a helicopter or done something with a private airplane, and they still chip and chip and chip and chip at his case. And this is one of those where I was involved in online stuff with the Young case, and there were some angry people out there, like some generic theories, just to see if, like, it stood up, what the prosecution was presenting stood up, made people online very angry. Because I this was the last case I was, like, super active with later, because it takes place over, like, it's another one of those, like, with Raymond Abaroa, they didn't arrest him right away. With Jason Young, they didn't arrest him right away. And to be honest with you, whoever committed the murder of Michelle Young was a coward. And the reason I say that is because they tried to strangle her to death and end up beating her to death. They, like, put a number in there, and they said it's at least this many times. It was terrible. And she was killed with a small kid in the house, which is same as the other.
Right.
And her sister found her and called 911. And I've always been bothered by, like, what is the real outcome in Jason Young's case? What do you think of this case?
I don't think, well, so I was not involved in this case. I know, I did know slightly more than I knew about the other case that we just did. But at this point in my life, I was, you know, not really following anything like this. But a minute ago I said, oh, wait, that's not this case. And so what I was thinking there, in this particular case, there is a whole bunch of video footage from sort of the hotel, and I assume by this point the whole story has been told. So he was in a hotel, and there was this back and forth about different things happening with surveillance footage at different times during his stay there. So he's out of town at a hotel. The camera is unplugged. There is a rock placed at an exit door. The camera is replugged in and for a very short space of time pointed at the ceiling. He explains that he did leave the door open, but not for the reason they think. So they present all this stuff, like he's on video footage here, there, and this is all the stuff that happens. But they never give an accurate description of when he actually is seen leaving the hotel. Did you notice that? I think that point It just, it really resonated with me because it seemed without closing out the circle of, okay, yes, he's seen here, he's not seen here, these weird things occurred. Where would they present all that without saying, yes, this is when he left? And so based on what I sort of found there, I was like, well, they should have closed that out because I have no idea when he actually left. And the thought behind his case was he had to have rused his business trip, returned home, even though he's shown checking into the hotel quite a ways away from his home. And so he would have had to have left and then returned to the hotel.
Well,
and as I'm saying that, I actually realized something. Maybe he didn't go back to the hotel. Now, they did say that he had a paper and
something else. So he checks in. He supposedly went out to smoke. And supposedly there was some shenanigans with the cameras there. But it doesn't really matter. He made a meeting the next day. But he was
30 minutes late.
But even being
because he got lost.
I have had those meetings before in the area he's talking about. Here's what – he would have had to driven all night to do that. If he was also part of the murder.
Right. But, okay, I don't discount that as being impossible. I feel like if you're going to murder your wife and try to alibi yourself, that would actually be
right. Ultimately, that's the biggest problem with this case, too. And here's what it boils down to. Just like the other cases we're covering, there's a lot of absence of evidence here. He plants some evidence in some smaller size shoes, supposedly, says the prosecution. He leaves his kid there with the body. That's where it gets disturbing for me.
Right, but if he did it, he just killed his wife. Like, why is leaving his kid there?
Oh, no. Okay, hold on. Of all the cases that we're covering today, this case has the most unique outcome. Do you know what the most unique outcome is?
They're
all found guilty of most of them are found guilty.
No, two of them.
Okay, but hold on. But what I'm saying is this guy is going to be in jail. This guy is going to do life in prison now, I think. I don't think there's any way. I think he's exhausted his appeal. Does that make sense? There's one more issue they could raise. I don't think they're going to raise it.
So he has
had multiple trials, and he is doing life in prison. That's what's different than these other cases because they couldn't offer him a plea deal. Okay, the reason they couldn't offer him a plea deal is because it's not second degree and it's not manslaughter. And it's either he didn't do it or it's first degree murder because of, like I said, he had to plan it to drive home and kill her.
Because either his alibi or his meditation.
Yeah, it's either his alibi or his premeditation. That's the end of it.
They could offer him a plea for life in prison.
Well, they could have, but they had already taken the death penalty off the table. You're saying life with parole?
Right. Well, I don't know, actually. My theory has always been, sort of based on what I've seen, the only reason somebody would take a deal with the result being life in prison would be to take the death penalty off the table and to avoid a trial, which sometimes the stress of a trial is enough to entice someone who might not otherwise plead out.
That's a shittier part of our justice system.
Isn't it, though? Yes, that is really bad. But I can see in some cases where that would be a thing. So you said that they couldn't plead him out because it would be first degree murder. But in order to avoid, an additional trial. Now, you said he has no recourse, but like every time he has a trial, recourse starts.
I agree with you there. I just think that he's gone up the chain and it's been this. I think this go round of appeals maybe hasn't gone, maybe it's completed. I'm not 100% sure of that, but essentially what happened was he got kicked back down for a new decision. There's some fucked up legal stuff about this case. I'll just go ahead and say that. The bigger.
Right, but some of it is, some of it was allowing different things in that shouldn't have been allowed in. They didn't completely disagree with everything that was. Raised on appeal. But
so ultimately, this case sort of played out beforehand in a wrongful death suit. And that is under the Slayer statute in North Carolina. So he was considered to be the killer of Michelle Young before he ever had a jury trial, before he had ever been arrested. That was one of the problems. One of the other problems was how they allowed testimony of the child, the small child. But they let in evidence of this daycare teacher talking about the child having witnessed something violent and reenacting it with dolls.
Right. And actually the Court of Appeals, they agreed that that should be
I'm not talking about whether they gave him a new trial on that. I'm saying I felt like it was shitty and unreliable. Then they found a witness who's apparently brain damaged. I kid you not.
No, she really was. That's what I'm saying.
I'm not saying.
Like she was hit by a car and her brain was messed up.
That's why I'm saying I'm not using it like a way to describe her appearance or anything. I am saying she literally had brain damage and was put on the stand as the only witness to having seen him in that area where he could have driven back from where he was in Virginia to North Carolina along the time it would have taken, where apparently he paid in cash and refilled the gas in his car. And this is, she was a terrible witness. Whether she's being truthful or not is completely irrelevant. The way that the prosecution and the defense treated her was with kid gloves because of brain damage. But ultimately, I think that she was a problematic witness in it all. And she came about in the second trial or the third trial. I don't know. She came about much later.
Yeah, I see. I don't.
It's very hard to track all of the legal processes of this case. I will just say that he either killed her with probably assistance, or he didn't kill her, and he's been atrociously treated by the system.
Okay, and so from that, so my perspective is, who did it? Right. Let's say it's not him, and in my mind, that's what I do because. Like I said in the other case, you know, confidence in the guilt of the spouse.
Well,
everything. Not
so.
Not
I just
want
to say
right?
that someone very close to me followed along with me on this case, and we have a lot of differing opinions about cases. They don't usually follow trials like start to finish, but this was one of the first trials, and it happened to be like available online in a really specific way where we could watch it together. And there were two of the trials like back to back like that. And so they watched both of them with me. And their opinion in this case is that he didn't do it. There's no way he could have done it. I don't share these opinions. I'm more open-minded than this person. I'm not going to name them either because they're going to be mad if I say it. But I will say that their conclusion is that the sister did it. That is all they said to me. And I'm like,
oh, I'm wow, like, really?
That doesn't even pop up on my possibility plate. So it ultimately made me stop, trying to interact with this person over true crime. But that's what they took away from the trials.
Well, that's interesting because I don't think the sister did it. But you said it was really not great that they allowed the hearsay from the daughter. I think that not in the judiciary procedures, but. As far as speaking to guilt or innocence, I think that that speaks very loudly. The child having that recreation with the dolls, and she says, mommy's being spanked because she was bad, and there's blood everywhere, and like, the child didn't make that up.
I was not implying that the child made it up. I don't think that I think the child could have heard that from other sources at that point in time.
Well, maybe. Yeah, that's possible, I guess. But, so part of this case that is so terrible. Now, there's so the husband, Jason Young, he calls the wife's sister to go retrieve some pieces of paper off the printer from their house under the guise that he's buying his wife a gift and he needs those pieces of paper to complete the purchase. And it's a secret. Right? Like it's a surprise gift. That's weird.
It felt very
all of that
construed.
Now, in a million gazillion years with a million gazillion husbands buying a million gazillion surprise gifts for a million gazillion wives, like how is it that you send your sister-in-law to go help you out on this and
I kept thinking there was going to be, I think that was guilt. If it's a premeditated crime, it's guilt
for
that he left
daughter,
the kid in the
middle
of it all.
And he felt like that would be a way to minimize his daughter's exposure without exposing him as killer. Because he knew his sister-in-law would find her. And, you know, I don't know. I imagine if Jason Young killed his wife, that he felt no worse about having her sister discover her body and, you know, rescue his daughter, so to speak. He didn't feel bad about that, like, because there was probably some contempt there or something. I don't know. I'm just saying that it is highly unlikely. Well, and, you know, I could ask more questions, and if I could get the answers, maybe I can make a more firm assessment. But had he ever bought a surprise gift for his wife?
No.
Had she ever been sent?
No, it became a thing.
Right. And, well, yeah, but, okay, so he exposed her to something that otherwise she would not have to have had to deal with. And, you know, I don't know if it was a wide opinion that perhaps a sister did kill her, but the sister didn't kill her.
Oh, I wasn't entertaining that as reality.
No, yeah, I know. But so, okay, if not her, if not Jason, well, who?
There's not a good case for anybody, really. And this is another one of those where they came up with a few things that, in this case, for the most part, they satisfied my questions and my curiosity, which is what they're supposed to do. They would come up with like a fingerprint, but it was pretty clearly like inlaid whenever painting had been done, and it was just an accident.
Right.
Even though it's an unknown fingerprint, but it's done by painters at some point in time, so they know that. Like there were a couple of items they came up with. This had one of the biggest pieces of evidence that I didn't really see explained. I think he was a size 13 shoe, and they had a size 10 bloody footprint on the pillowcase, and they're saying his giant foot couldn't make that little footprint. They're saying he basically put on shoes that were too small. And did that.
Or just held a shoe, dipped in blood.
Right, but I mean, you know, so again, we're in that situation where if he did it, it's premeditated.
Right, and so there's also banter that he was having an affair. She was pregnant, right?
I think she was, yeah. This is one of those where they, like, tore into personal lives, not just of the defendant, but, like, other people. They just shredded them on the stand.
Right, and, you know, actually, there is... Well, maybe it's just because I've only watched those trials, but they have a tendency to do that there in that specific area.
Like, it happens a lot in court cases, but they do it more. So the next case we talk about, and this case, was more than I'd ever seen it in one particular trial. There was a lot of character assassination going on. And like, I understood why they were doing it, but like, they did it enough here that I started to feel sympathetic for the defendant.
Jason Young.
I started to feel like they were just raking him over the coals, because there comes a point in there, like, what was interesting about this case is if it's premeditated, it's nearly a perfect murder. Not quite, but it's close for what we've seen personally in crimes. It's really well premeditated if it's premeditated. And by the time you assassinate his character the way they assassinated his character, I start to think that he's a buffoon who couldn't plan this murder. And then I'm back on, but he did get caught, so there's that. But the two things they contradict each other big time.
Okay, so Jason Young's alibi was too good. It was too overthought. It was too much, because if it had all occurred and he was innocent, it wouldn't be like this question of whether or not he was innocent.
Yeah, it's...
Right? Like, if he really was at a hotel... Yeah, it became
the odds of a lightning strike in there.
That's where it starts getting, like, too... Like, it's just too perfect. And it's like he was trying too hard to alibi himself and make it impossible for him to have done what he did. Now, something interesting I saw was one of the neighbors... I don't know if they were just talking or if it was actual testimony, but they saw a man and a woman, and, you know, he was having an affair.
I don't think it's the same person though. So his affair was not as involved as, hey, help me murder this person. If that makes sense. Like,
it wasn't just one.
I don't think. That's what I'm saying. Like, you get into the good alibi. You're right, though. It does make full circle back around, because he was an awful person.
Well, right. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, as you know, I try to not take, I don't care if they're an awful person or not. I don't necessarily think sometimes the best people could murder somebody. honestly, like from a standpoint.
I agree, but like there's just a point in time where you have to like make a decision as a prosecutor, and you can bring yourself too far. You can assassinate someone's character or show someone as a buffoon to the point that like you accidentally show that they probably couldn't have committed this crime.
Right. Okay. So where did you land with that? Did you land in the...
I'm pretty sure Jason Young killed his wife.
Right. Okay. And he was not successful. And so that goes along with his buffoonism to the extent...
And it comes all the way back around like Angela Lansbury style.
Right. And because in the event that he really had gone out of town to be at this business meeting and he had stayed at a hotel, like it wouldn't boil down to like, do they believe this alibi or not?
Well,
it would just be obvious that that's what
right. And so I guess that one, even though it's the only one in this area where the defendant is still in prison, like right now, we'll talk about that in a second, but that's about to change, but we'll talk about that in 1 second. Do you think he did this? And yeah, do you think he had help?
I think I never thought about that until I saw where one of the neighbors saw a woman, and then I had taken it in the
there was a postal carrier too. There was a neighbor and a postal carrier that both
right. And but they so another thing with that was like two different people saw two different things, and that got confusing. And it was like one saw a soccer
mom, yeah, like the little vehicle, minivan thing,
which right. And then another one saw an SUV, a light colored SUV, and it had a man and a woman in it. So even those things you sort of have to take with a grain of salt because they saw two completely different things, right? They're, you know, looking at the case, I don't see where it was anybody else. I don't see, like I've said, like how does someone get stabbed or strangled in their house and have access? And, you know, as far as I know, the little girl didn't allude to anyone else having been there.
Well, it was kind of a long murder for the kid not to have seen something or heard something.
Right, which she then expressed to the next closest adult that she felt she could, which was the daycare worker. That was her way of
And
speaking up.
So I don't know, again, all these cases to me that we're covering, all these cases that we're covering related to this particular set of episodes, I could be convinced that they didn't do it if it was something weird and you showed me like a pattern of burglaries that were particularly violent in their area. And we'll pick up with the last two cases next week.
Thanks for joining us. You can reach us at 252-365-5593 or at truecrimexcess.com or truecrimexcess@gmail.com if you want to send us a note. This episode was brought to you by LabrotiCreations.com. That's LabrotiCreations.com. Check out the merchandise and specifically their fun pop pet art custom pieces made from photos of your very own pets. Use the promo code CRIMEXS, that's CRIMEXS, for 20% off a fun, brightly colored, happy piece of art of your own pet at their site. AbradiCreations.com. Music in this episode was licensed for True Crime XS. The theme song was Indestructible by Noah Smith. You can find us on your favorite podcast platform or at TeePublic, Instagram, or Twitter. You can also join us on Patreon to fund future body exploration trips. But the best thing you can do for us is leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform and share us with your friends. And we'll see you next time.
This is True Crime XS.
One of Wake County's most prominent murder cases is headed back to court. Right now on WRAL, why Jason Young will go on trial a third time. 7 years after Michelle Young's death, her husband will defend himself a third time. Thank you for joining us. I'm David Crabtree.
And I'm Deborah Morgan. The case goes back to 2006 when Michelle Young was found beaten to death in their home. Their little girl was in the house but unharmed. In Jason Young's first murder trial, jurors could not agree on a verdict.
This jury is hopelessly deadlocked, withdraws the juror and declares a mistrial.
After only 3 weeks of testimony, the jury did deadlock. WREL learned the jury was split 8-4 with a majority leaning toward acquittal. Less than a year later, Young was back in court. This time, there was a decision.
We, the jury, by unanimous verdict, find the defendant, Jason Lynn Young, to be guilty of first-degree murder.
That verdict came after less than 2 full days of deliberation. Young received a life sentence. However, his lawyers kept fighting.
And today, the State Court of Appeals threw out that conviction and paved the way for a third trial. WREL's Julia Sims joins us live with a look at this ruling today. Julia?
Deborah, that Court of Appeals ruling found that that second trial was flawed. The judge made a mistake, and simply put, Jason Young didn't get a fair trial.
This case, correct?
Yes, sir.
During Jason Young's retrial, jurors heard days and days of testimony. They heard about the volatile relationship between Jason and his wife, Michelle. They heard about how the young pregnant wife was beaten to death. They heard about a multi-million dollar life insurance policy. But the Court of Appeals ruled the jury never should have heard about a wrongful death lawsuit filed by Michelle Young's family.
Was unfairly prejudicial to the defendant.
Defense attorney Dan Boyce, who is not connected to the Young case, points out criminal and civil cases carry a very different burden of proof. Jason Young refused to respond to the civil suit regarding his wife's murder. By default, he was found responsible for her death. The Court of Appeals said that information likely had an impact on the guilty verdict.
It's highly unusual to have both a mistrial and then a reversal and remand for an entirely new trial.
In Young's first trial, he testified in his own defense. There was no mention of the wrongful death suit and its outcome. In the retrial, Young didn't testify, and jurors heard about that civil suit. Boyce points out a third trial clearly benefits Jason Young, but says neither side will have the edge when it comes to strategy.
Here, the prosecution and defense have to go back to square one.
Now, Jason Young has always maintained that he didn't do it. He said that he was on a business trip hundreds of miles away and simply couldn't have done it. So what's next, Deborah? Well, the district attorney's office will have to decide if they take this all the way to the state Supreme Court.
So what's the possible time frame for a new trial?
Well, typically, Deborah, once the Court of Appeals makes their ruling, then the district attorney's office typically has about 60 days to decide whether or not to go appeal to the state Supreme Court. After that, it's anybody's guess because it's really up to the district attorney's office. But I was told they would likely do it sooner rather than later.
Julia Sims, live in downtown Raleigh. Thank you.
Rulings from the Supreme Court could send 2 more high-profile cases back into the courtroom. In December, the court refused to hear an appeal on the Mike Peterson murder trial. That means a judge's 2011 order for a retrial on the death of Peterson's wife, Kathleen, stands. No date has been set. And in January, the court upheld a ruling that Brad Cooper deserved a new trial in his wife's death because of a judge's error. Scheduling that trial may be delayed, however, because of the changes in the Wake District Attorney's office.
That see right
sun.